Today I'm joined by eminent art historian Professor Barbara Stafford, the W.B. Ogden Distinguished Service Professor Emerita at the University of Chicago. Professor Stafford studied for her B.A. and M.A. at the Northwestern University and at the University of Chicago for her Ph.D. A fellowship from the American Association of University Women also enabled her to study with Ernst Gombrich at the Warburg Institute in London. Barbara Stafford's work has consistently explored the intersections between the visual arts and the physical and biological sciences, from the early modern period to the present digital age. Recently, she has begun to focus on the way neuroscience changes our fundamental assumptions about perception, sensation, emotion, mental imagery, and subjectivity. She's published extensively and won many awards and prizes, including the American Society for 18th Century Studies Clifford Prize, the Alexander von Humboldt Senior Prize, and most recently won the Michelle Kendrick Memorial Book Prize of the Society for Literature, Sciences and Arts for her book Echo Objects, The Cognitive Work of Images. She has also been concerned with the vital significance of the visual arts to general education. She has also co-curated an innovative exhibition at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles entitled Devices of Wonder, From the World in a Box to Images on a Screen. Professor Stafford has been a professor at the University of Chicago since 1981 and is currently working on a cognitive history of images. She's awarded an honorary Doctor of Letters. Welcome to the University of Warwick, Professor Stafford, and congratulations on receiving your honorary degree today.
Thank you, thank you.
Tell me, first of all, what receiving this award means to you.
Gosh, what a question, what a difficult question. It means enormous things to me because I feel that for a while, for a considerable while, I'd really been rather a voice crying in the wilderness. I mean, making the argument, first of all, for the profound art-science connection, and secondly, the argument for the intelligence of the visual more generally, as opposed to really a kind of valorization of text, textuality, language and linguistics, as it really has dominated, I think, also not just humanistic, but scientific discourse. So to be recognized today is maybe a record, to me, is profoundly meaningful because it means that perhaps that message has really gotten across at last.
What did you know of Warwick before you came here?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, of course I know of your university. I had never visited it before. I didn't know that. And I had met your chancellor, I think it is, Nigel Thrift.
Vice-chancellor, yes.
Vice-chancellor Nigel Thrift before. I think actually in my earlier International Society for 18th Century Studies days. I think that that was the first time our paths crossed. And then again, in a very interesting conference on geography and digital systems in general, especially GPS systems and how that's really changing that field rather profoundly. And I brought the cognitive dimension into that. So I think those were the two times.
Oh, fantastic. A quote from your website says, "My work has been to passionately put the study of images right at the heart of the major intellectual issues of our times." Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. I think going back to the very first statement I made, I think that we are so used to the power of prose, if you will, or the persuasion and the importance of words have to say, and I think perhaps even unintentionally, the concomitant reduction of the work of images, that images are merely illustrative. They simply illustrate that which already exists in another medium, a prior medium, usually a textual medium. And I would say, again, that my entire life's work has really been to argue that images do a different kind of work. And what's quite exciting to me about the neurosciences is, and work by people like Stanislas Dehaene recently, that even reading the primary impetus for that actually comes out of the visual and out of pattern recognition before we think of the higher centers of literacy or for literacy. And to me, that's that really is an argument that needs to be made. And consequently, that's what I mean. I mean that images really do intellectual work. And different kinds of images do different kinds of intellectual work, just as an epic or novel or narrative, different language genres do different kinds of work. And I think people don't recognize that as much as they might, and that it's massively important for our current media-based society.
So in your earlier research, you went back to the 18th century examining how people have become fascinated with the human body, the way it looks, functions, what's inside.
Right.
What was so special about that period in history?
Well, I think the 18th century is really an absolutely pivotal period, a pivotal epoch, because many of the institutions and the ideas that were coalescing, I would say, in the Renaissance and in the 17th century, they are there, but they are also beginning to unravel and move in the direction of what we consider the making of our modern consciousness. If you think about pedagogy, if you think about law, if you think about, well, since we're in the area of the visual, if you think of the artfulness of imagery, the way in which science, actually the kind of transdisciplinarity that we're aiming for today, where science from chemistry to incipient biology to astronomy was something that also impinged on salon society, on just a variety of different fields. And there was really no artificial division the way, for example, the 19th century, post-Humboldt's Berlin, when universities really became founded and grounded, the German method, especially of departments and units, that encouraged a special kind of specialization. So that the 18th century is, in a way, this wonderful bubble moment when one could see that all sorts of fields really were overlapping as they were developing, as they were emerging. And it seems to me that that really impelled me then also much more into the contemporary world. In other words, I retained my roots in the past and could still be profoundly interested in issues that crystallized in the past, but I also saw their pertinence, I think, in very sharp relief for the 20th century. And I think the 18th century, in a way, makes you do that for those reasons.
So do you think now we're in the kind of digital age, digital media has revolutionized creating, processing, accessing art, images?
Yes.
And it's also an influence on our own opinions and what we think and what we feel.
Sure.
How do you see this impacting on our lives? Has this had such a dramatic change as maybe that happened in the 18th century?
Well, I think that, not only the explosion of newer media, that is electronic-based media, but the fact of their intermixing, the fact of the mashup. I mean, I think one can never let go of the past, because one of the great lessons, I think, of, I would say, of the Enlightenment, and I am really pro-Enlightenment, I believe it did some very wonderful things. It is not just, as it emerged out of the Frankfurt School, the origin of everything bad and to be dismissed. I think it really gives us a handle on how to constructively think our way around problems that electronic imagery brings, especially speed, especially, as I said, the mashup of many media. You're not just talking about visual media anymore. You're talking about all sorts of media that are mashed and merged together by powers that you do not know. And I would really argue that many of the technologies, and there were, of course, rather wonderful optical devices and technologies that date back to the early modern period, that many of the qualities that they encouraged in their beholders or in their users, slowness, I'm thinking of devices really now, I'm thinking of things like vue d'optique that very gradually change from light to dark, from night to day, and so on, which actually fostered attention and attentiveness, something that we don't have in our newer media at all. You know, you flit from one mashed concern to another. I think that maybe some of those qualities really need to be almost artificially programmed back into newer media, so that the past is always a wonderful reservoir for learning. It's not about nostalgia, it's about pertinency. What is still pertinent? How might we look at things again? And not just for our own, 21st century purposes, but actually helping us to reinterpret that earlier period as well with the knowledge that we've gleaned today. I mean, I always think it's a quality or parity back and forth. So that's what I would say. It helps us deal with a period where things are absolutely being blended very, very quickly. And frequently, we know we don't know by whom or by what. And it helps us ask, the proper questions of those activities. At least, I'd like to argue it does.
So your most recent research has begun to look at neuroscience and medical imaging techniques. What are you learning from this field of science?
Oh my gosh! Well, I the medical issue. I mean, the Art and Science book, the Body Criticism book, really got me into this a number of years ago, and for the last, I would say, about 7 years, because I became a member of the Computational Neuroscience Seminar at the University of Chicago, because it's one thing to read this material, but quite another to understand it and to teach courses where I took my students into labs. And what I became aware of is a little bit of what I said today in my response to Professor Lambert's oration. Namely, I became aware that the questions that are being asked by the neurosciences are actually the same big questions that have been and continue to be asked by the humanities. For example, questions, something that social sciences call social cognition, mirroring. How do you create relationships? Why is it I can look at you when I have some intuition of what it is you're thinking? Well, that's the whole way that one actually approaches the world. I mean, something that came out of monkey research, that has now had profound ramifications. There's not just one mirror system, not just a visual mirror system. There's an auditory mirroring system. That is that the way we learn about anything and everything in the world that involves some level of motion or action or behavior is by virtually internalizing it and reenacting it. And to me, it's a very beautiful and rich concept. Of course, it's the entire Aristotelian theory of mimesis, goes back to the mimetic. Why is imitation such an important factor in aesthetic theory? So that it illuminates that long, long humanistic tradition, but I would also argue that the deep thinking that has gone on around mimesis, theories of imitation in art, the difference between a copy, a hard copy, and a softer copy, all of those things could also and should, I believe, influence scientific research. So that's just one example. And I became aware that new work on memory, the entire industry on affect in the study of emotions, for example, that's out there from people like Antonio Damasio to Yap Pansep to, I mean, it's just a whole industry on the science side, cognitive science, and especially, I think, the neuroanatomists, that that those sorts of issues, again, are issues, the issues of the passions, whether one's talking about Descartes, the Cartesian passions, to Spinoza's pathema in the Ethics. I mean, all of that, again, two fields or two huge areas that have been existing in parallel, and yet they're asking the same question. They need to come together, and they need to come together at a high level. So that's really, I would say, what propelled me then to really pursue this, to teach it. I mean, I teach a graduate seminar in neuroaesthetics, and to really, and this is what I will be doing in Georgia Tech. I was hired across the university to build a new program, help build and design a new program, binding together the humanities and the neuro and biosciences. I mean, really, and including architecture. I mean, it's totally across the entire spate of Georgia Tech, which is in a way the perfect place to do it because they are so strong in the sciences. Emory, which is up the road, is very strong in cognitive science, and Franz de Waal is there, works on animal, especially animal expression, animal emotion, ethology. So it's a wonderful place to begin to develop a program in that. So I think the moment has come. I mean, I think the humanities have in some ways run dry, and I think the sciences are dry in their own way. And I think we just need to come around the same issues. I think we are really, whether we admit it or not, driven by the same issues now.
You're obviously very passionate about this subject.
Yes, I love it. I think it's wonderful.
Are you still passionate about teaching, being a professor?
Yes, well, I am. I go back, and as I said, after I've conducted my big move, I start teaching on the 23rd of August, and I begin with an undergraduate, cross-university undergraduate course, which I'm very, very excited on, which has to do exactly with this, taking a problem. I mean, the hard thing is always taking a problem that's equally gripping, that everybody cares with the same intensity about. And I'm going to be talking about really the question of media, past and present, and the ways in which media, historical or very contemporary, have always, in a way, been addressing certain areas of our brain to produce certain effects, whether we call them illusions, whether we call them what. But it's a different way of looking at the media problem. And the ultimate question then that comes out of that is, well, what can we learn by looking at it that way, both for the sciences, engineering, and on the architecture and humanities side of things? How might it make us rethink the design of newer media, to create responsible media? So that's just an example. Yes, I'm very interested in teaching, and that would be a question I just instantiate in that course, which I'm now just going to teach.
What advice would you give to your fellow graduates today?
Gosh, what advice? Well, in a way, what I said to them, that it's why I'm against the mashup. It's extremely important to know things. You really, I believe in expertise. I do. I really do. You remember there was a period where we weren't supposed to believe, and it was kind of a free-for-all, and I hated that word interdisciplinarity because it sounded just like a big mashed potatoes or something, you know? But I prefer transdisciplinarity because it suggests that you actually have training, you have skills. And I would encourage them that to have that. You need it. And the more training and the more skills you have, the better you are. In other words, not just a little, you know, when I was in school, there was a major and a minor, and the minor was theoretically, you know, less important than the major. I think we should have majors and majors, and they should be in very, very different areas. So that I would encourage them to really be schooled, I would say that, to be schooled in a field. And at the same time, to be able to rise above it and to move across. And I think there's a truth in that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And therefore, that's why I'm for expertise, because you think, oh, hell, I don't know this. And I've got to go learn it. And I'm not just going to Google it, you know, I'm just really going to nail myself down and learn it. So that's what I would advise them, that they need to do that, that they really need to know something and not just Google. And secondly, that they also see, sort of do an up periscope and see how much is out there. You know, you can't master it all, but at least you have to realize that you are not mastering it all. And by God, there's a lot out there that you need to know. So that's really what I want to urge them to do while they're, I believe in neuroplasticity. You know, you learn, and that's for adult education too. I mean, I think it goes across the board.
Well, Professor Stanford, thank you very much for speaking with me today. I hope you've enjoyed your time here at Warwick. And once again, congratulations on receiving your Honorary Doctor of Letters here.
Thank you so much.